Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, as the Israeli regime's genocide against Palestinians continues, more than 31,600 people have been killed. This includes the slaughtering of over 13,000 infants and kids. As Netanyahu continues to say Israel has a right to defend itself, more and more settler colonialists inside of the regime are protesting and clashing with police. They say regime leaders have created more insecurity for the people and have not freed the captives. The settler colonialists want a change in the regime. This as increasingly some of the regime's closest allies are starting to, at least on the surface, distance themselves from Netanyahu. But in reality, what does it all mean? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this and more on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Sarah Flounders, International Action Center out of New York. And Syed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. Well, welcome both of you to the program. Let me start it off in New York. And Sarah, is the main problem with the Israeli regime due to Netanyahu being prime minister, or is the reality beyond who is prime minister?
Well, it is far beyond Netanyahu. This is Zionist policy from day one for 75 years and even earlier. But right now, there are U.S. politicians that are desperate to save Israel as a Zionist outpost for U.S. domination and power in the region. And they seem to think maybe the only way forward is to dump Netanyahu. Clearly, that was true in Senator Schumer's statements the other day, and an increasing number of politicians. They face a real problem that Israel's global reputation has been absolutely destroyed. It's clearly been proven it's no longer invincible. It's certainly not the Iron Dome, the new tanks, the missiles, the weapons. They have all been found to be not so invincible at all. But also Israel's reputation, its standing, has been completely destroyed. And overwhelmingly, even here in the U.S., more than two-thirds of the population is for the Palestinians. Now, that's a big problem for U.S. politicians, Democrat and Republican. They're both Zionists, absolutely. But they face an election coming up, so they got to act like they're for something different. Whether there's anything different that's even possible, that's a real question, because everything means they still want Israel to survive, and that is what is being threatened and challenged by a unified resistance.
Well, Syed Mohsen, we've seen across the board support for the genocide in Gaza from all factions of the Israeli regime, as well as from the settler colonialists on the ground themselves. I mean, your thoughts overall, is there actually a divide between the people and that regime? And is it related to the genocide itself, or is it related to how they are being affected by it all?
Well, it's a very fascinating situation internally. The people, the Jewish occupation of citizenry, etc., is certainly behind the war. They're certainly behind the genocidal tactics being used by Netanyahu, but they're not necessarily for Benjamin Netanyahu himself. He was in trouble long before this war, and in fact, there were all sorts of issues constitutionally and in terms of the whole the grave political, constitutional, and domestic crisis, which he'd brought about through his own efforts to try to reduce the judiciary's power, to increase his own power, to bring in essentially a Jewish religious jurisprudence of a hugely fundamentalist nature. There was hardly anything secular left within the plans that they were rolling out. And essentially, he's increased the racist approach to Palestinians, if that could be increased anymore, with the necessity that he's created of support from ultra-nationalists, ultra-extreme, violent Jewish politicians like Smotrich and all the other entourage that have become very infamous across the screens. But in reality also, that public which is backing the war, which also doesn't necessarily like Netanyahu, is hugely aware now that the entire north part of Israel has been evacuated. So the war, which by extension obviously drew in Hezbollah, has essentially created a huge deal of paranoia. I mean, entire settlements in that northern part of occupied Palestine had to be evacuated. That's one result of this war, which gets little coverage. But the Israeli public is even more insecure as a result of this, because don't forget, what they haven't forgiven Netanyahu for is the failure of security. He was Mr. Security, and yet what he's done in October the 7th has created the biggest amount of paranoia and insecurity among the Israeli public that's ever been known. On top of that, he's failed on the retrieval of hostages. He's failed in terms of wiping out Hamas, which was another pledge of his. What he has done is also undermined Israel's cover story, which was that they were the victims and that the Palestinians were terrorists. Now, well, of course, what's happened is the whole world sees the emperor is naked. Mm-hmm. They can realize that he has no clothes, and that all the lies of the Hasbara are there for the world to see. And I think Israel's standing certainly won't recover from this. What the implications of that are for its long-term survival are, of course, open to debate.
Well, Sarah, the demonstrations on Saturday in Tel Aviv and other cities led to the first major clashing amongst Israelis and security forces since October the 7th. Is this significant and indicative of a transition taking place inside of the regime, in your perspective?
Well, there has been a growing number of demonstrations, disruptions, encampments, vigils going on within Israel among the Zionist forces. They are deeply, completely divided, and the animosity and the failure of security that rankles deep. And it will grow worse and worse, because in the hundreds of thousands, Israelis have left Israel itself, either to avoid being drafted or just wanting no part of this war. That's a big loss. The economy is in shambles. Unemployment is really higher than it's ever been. And their standing in the world is completely shattered and lost. So the divisions are real, and the growing actual fights, repression, so on, are becoming stronger and stronger. The failure on every front of the aims of the war in terms of regaining the hostages, defeating Hamas, all that, here it is more than 5 months in, and they haven't succeeded in anything. So that will mean greater division and greater hostility within the state, which is an illusion from its very beginning. So now you have millions of people waking up and frustrated and angry. So will they break with Zionism? Very few of them, because the racism is so deeply ingrained. But will they break in all kinds of ways against the government? That's what it certainly looks like is happening. And then there also are voices who really were never for this policy, who are becoming more outspoken and gutsy. So there are a lot of tensions going on in Israel today. And also the big thing that everyone in Israel knows is that world support has completely broken and U.S. support is waning. So this is a fragile effort from the very beginning, and now it's in really, bad shape. Israel can't prevail. And as I say, they've lost support everywhere. It's a failed policy. And that will create greater and greater tension, animosity, opposition within the Israeli state.
Well, Said Mohsen, speaking of the captives, I mean, protesters say that Netanyahu has done nothing to try to reach a deal to bring the captives home. Do you think that the reality is that the regime leaders really did not want the captives to be returned home?
Well, the Hannibal Directive is something which is on record, and it's something which the Israeli establishment had decided was going to be a policy, and they've exercised that policy quite ruthlessly. It essentially says that in a situation where hostages or Israeli lives can be saved, and the alternative, of course, is to stop their military actions, they will always plumb for sacrificing the hostages. And that's what Netanyahu has done, essentially. He's actually responsible for directly killing many of those hostages. Many of them have been essentially murdered alongside all those women and children, the 31,000 plus and who've been killed from the Palestinian civilian fraternity. So his own people's blood is on his hands. There are huge questions he has to answer in terms of what his military forces were doing on October the 7th when they sent in Apache helicopters and mowed down Israeli citizens, essentially. You know, he's got to answer for those issues. So to be honest with you, there is a clear set of evidence that this establishment's incompetence in dealing with this whole situation from start to finish, and it's now very well documented, genocide and ethnic cleansing and starvation of a people who are already destitute and on their last legs is recorded, and he is now spoken, ultimately, he's going to be spoken in the same breath as names like Pol Pot, Hitler, and Churchill, I'd like to add, because these people were all responsible for some of the biggest genocides of the 20th century. Well, congratulations, Netanyahu, you've managed to get yourself in an auspicious list there, and that won't go away. Israel itself is now also tarred with that brush. Nobody's buying the victim story. But what they will do is they'll try and their advisors are already trying to do this. What they're planning is to meet this challenge by essentially getting new political realignments done in the backgrounds. So Benny Gantz and the National Unity Party, for instance, will be pushed, I think, into the foreground as the replacement. They'll probably try and bring together some kind of coalition which will try to, patch things over. I mean, they've already tripled their popularity in the various general election polls. So we know that the NUP will be rewarded for this war, and Benny Gantz is the one to watch. But then Benny Gantz's policies are not going to be that different from Netanyahu. He's part and parcel of this Zionist terrorist mindset. And unless they are willing to really give the rights of Palestinians, unless they're willing to concede the land and give people back their properties, allow the repatriation of all Palestinians expelled and their heritage, children who've been born abroad, unless they're willing to settle for a one-state solution which is based on democracy and the rights of Palestinians, we're not going to see an end to this situation.
Right.
In fact, what they've done is they've bred an entire generation of Palestinians who will now fight, literally fight, for the return of their people's rights.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Sarah, some of the protesters were saying that the policy has to change by the Israeli regime towards Palestinians, or Israel will no longer exist. Your assessment of that statement, I mean, is there a greater awareness by the settler colonialists that the regime is in danger?
I think so, Marzia, and I very much agree with Syed that that what it would take, though, is something which would really mean the end of Zionism. Mm-hmm. I mean, it means the return of these settlements. It means, Israel out of Gaza. It means the end of the attacks. That's the only way. And that seems to be almost an impossibility. That's not on Benny Gantz's agenda or any of the Israeli politicians. So that is the quandary. They have an absolutely failed war. They're no longer clearly invincible. That's been completely destroyed. And dumping Netanyahu or a new coalition government won't fix this, won't solve it. And the U.S. is desperately seeking for a way to act like they're not for this policy, they're for something else. Can they restabilize? And that doesn't seem to be in the works. It's not in the works even because of the actions taken in Yemen by the Ansarallah movement. The blockade, the Israeli ports are all but closed. So while they have imposed a complete closure and created a famine in Gaza, they haven't been able to open their own economy as a thriving economy it was. So they can't seem to prevail anywhere, either economically or militarily. The big win that they expected, it isn't in the cards with any of the Israeli politicians. This is a real crisis that they face, and actually that U.S. imperialism faces, because they have completely banked on Israel from its very foundation, and now they see it literally crumbling. They see the population at each other's throats, and many others just opting to leave out of the whole project. It's a big problem, and it's part of global change that is really happening among many countries, realigning and rethinking where they stand.
Well, speaking of that, actually, of that realignment, said Mohsen, as the regime continues to be adamant about its invasion of Rafah and continues to commit mass murder on a daily basis, do you think that there is real distancing taking place on an international level of some of the international allies of the regime, or is it just for show?
I think there's a lot of show. There's no genuineness about the allies. The allies are fully part and parcel of the genocide. They've been aiding and abetting the murder of the genocide, the ethnic cleansing, with weapon supplies. Hundreds of thousands of tons of weapons from Germany, from Britain, from America have been pouring in. Their alliances are just as solid as they were before. In fact, what one has to realize that Israel is their means for controlling West Asia. But what's happened is that Israel's own, invincibility has been undermined so much that it's putting doubts in erstwhile allies. This is what's really important. The likes of Saudi Arabia, the likes of Jordan, Egypt, all these collaborators in the genocide of Palestine, because don't forget the Saudis have been allowing food and commodities to come through their territories into Jordan via UAE. Don't forget that Egypt has been trying to prevent Yemeni ballistic missiles reaching Israel, and are also wholly and solely responsible for the starvation that's going on also from the Rafah crossing, because they are also hand in glove with Israel with this policy. So it's this exposure of the regional Israeli allies, covert, many of them previously covert, now are exposed. Saudi Arabia is finding increasingly embarrassing. Turkey and the likes of Azerbaijan have been exposed for their oil exports. So Israel's actions have actually exposed all of the collaborators, and the public knows. The Arab public in the region now knows. And I think that realization isn't going to go away. It will affect those governments, and it's also exposed the likes of the Zionist Western establishment clearly. China,
stay
Russia,
with me, said Mohsen, because I only have a couple of minutes left. I want to get a couple more questions in. Well, Sarah, U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer, a staunch Zionist supporter of the regime in Washington, has said that Netanyahu has lost his way and is an obstacle to peace. What are your thoughts on why Schumer is saying that now, and what does it really mean?
Well, Schumer is an arch Zionist, strongest Zionist, longest supporter of Israel in the U.S., top representative. So Netanyahu has lost his way, and it just means Schumer is in a panic, how to distance himself from this politician who's now radioactive. That is the problem. And so Schumer's got to act like he's for something different. What it is, he doesn't say. And frankly, he doesn't know. That is what they can't overcome. And it's also true in the U.S. and Britain. These are the supporters, the EU, these are the supporters of Zionism from the very beginning. And now, frankly, they are scared. They are worried, and they don't have an option. That this is the quandary that they're in.
Okay.
And the regime that were complicit in Western Asia, and I'm talking about, as I did, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, they're also now looking east. They are looking to new relations. There no longer is the U.S. and the, you know, that imperialist economy the only game in town.
Okay, stay with me, Sarah. So sorry to interrupt you. And Said Mohsen, at the end of the day, is there anything besides, or any group besides the resistance that is going to bring this genocide against Palestinians in Gaza to an end?
No. The only chance that exists for the liberation of Palestinians, in my opinion, is the resistance of the people inside Palestine and the support of the resistance both in from Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and Yemen. I mean, the reality is that I don't know of any peoples in history who have managed to overthrow the kind of oppressor that Israel is, the kind of vicious oppressor that Israel ideologically is, by peaceful means. And we've not seen any evidence for the Western powers or the UN or any of the apparatus controlled by the Anglo-Zionist Empire in really being serious to create any solution for Palestinians. Okay. We're seeing more and more of the same. It has to be a military resistance which is going to ultimately achieve Israel's downfall.
Thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Sarah Flanders from the International Action Center out of New York, Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye for now.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, learning from Ramadan, but living Ramadan in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, an honor to be here at your service. Dear listeners, we are humbly talking about living Ramadan and experiencing Ramadan in our Islamic lifestyle. So, some time has already passed in the holy month of Ramadan, and alhamdulillah, we are feeling the benefits and the advantages of the holy month of Ramadan. Yes, it is difficult, but the rewards and the benefits for every single one of us are really unimaginable. You know, we talked about in one of our previous programs how one of the most fundamental benefits of the holy month of Ramadan is this connection that we establish with the Almighty Allah. And, you know, we said how this connection that we establish with the Almighty Allah is something which brings us relaxation and peace of mind, and it reduces our stress and our depression, and you can look back at that episode to know more. But so we have all these different benefits that we are receiving in the holy month of Ramadan, right? We are trying our best to eat healthier. We are trying our best to live healthier. Or if we want to put it in other terms, we are trying to eat, in accordance with a Islamic lifestyle. We are trying to live in accordance to a Islamic lifestyle because, you know, in reality, the holy month of Ramadan is exactly that. It is this refresher when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. It's like the holy month of Ramadan teaches us, once again, every single year, what an Islamic lifestyle truly is, so that we can live that Ramadan and we can experience that that holy month of Ramadan.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about living the holy month of Ramadan. We are talking about living a Islamic lifestyle. You know, this is something that we really need to take into consideration. We need to realize, we need to understand fundamentally, you know, that the holy month of Ramadan is here to help us. The holy month of Ramadan is here to purify us. The holy month of Ramadan is here to help us connect with the Almighty Allah. You know, we live a life that is so busy and we're running all the time and we're doing so many things and there's a lot of stress and there's a lot of anxiety and people are depressed and people are sad. And in this kind of an environment where you live like this the whole year, because of the materialistic and very Western culture that, you know, has been placed upon humanity and is dominating everywhere, unfortunately, we have a tendency to forget this Islamic lifestyle. And so this holy month of Ramadan, the things that we are learning, the Islamic lifestyle that we are learning to live once again, is something that should not stay in the holy month of Ramadan. It should continue through the rest of the year. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. So alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, 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 ya Habib. Ramadan, Ramadan.
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Afghanistan's reliance on Pakistan for access to international markets has been a long-standing challenge. However, recent disputes have pushed the Taliban authorities to seek alternatives. The Taliban have said they will invest around $35 million in Iran's Chabahar port, located in the country's southeast. The move aims to reduce Afghanistan's economic dependence on Pakistan, which has been marred by political friction and trade disruptions.
Chabahar.
Bazaar is one of the most important economic and trade routes for Afghanistan. The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan tries to have a strong bilateral economic and trade relations with Iran as part of its economic policy. This port allows Afghanistan to broaden its trade with Iran, West Asia, and Europe. That's why we are especially focused on Chabahar and seek to invest there.
Analysts believe this could be a turning point for Afghanistan's international trade relations. They say that Iran has been an ideal trade partner for Afghanistan, and accessing Chabahar port will further facilitate Afghanistan's regional cooperation.
The benefits of Chabahar port for Afghanistan include its short distance with the country's borders. It allows goods to enter our country at a low price. It is especially suitable with the overall economic situation of Afghans. Another benefit is that it opens a big route for our exports, which is in dire need of expansion. When we become able to expand our exports, our economy will grow rapidly.
As the Taliban government seeks to diversify its trade routes and reduce its reliance on Pakistan, the decision to invest in Iran's Chabahar port marks a significant shift in Afghanistan's economic strategy. Experts say the outcome of this move will not only impact Afghanistan's relations with Pakistan, but also shape the geopolitical dynamics in the region. Iran and Afghanistan have the potential and opportunity to cooperate in many fields. Trade and industry in particular can bring the two neighbors closer in a very volatile region. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The recent European Council President Charles Michel's warning that the European Union needs to ramp up its military production and shift to a war economy mode in response to an alleged threat posed by Russia has sparked international alarm and mixed reactions in Europe. Earlier this week, Michel wrote in an opinion editorial run by a media specialized in EU affairs that if Europe wants peace, it must prepare for war, arguing that although the EU's military manufacturing capacity has increased by 50% since the start of the Ukraine-Russia war in 2022, far more was needed.
Our European awakening is just beginning to take shape, and I would like to tell you what I feel. The time has come to create a real union of defence coupled with a true defence single market.
Michel added that the European Union must finally take responsibility for its own security. For decades, the European Union has relied heavily on the United States and the Western military alliance NATO for its security. Analysts believe that the dependency on external powers by the 27-member bloc has resulted in a complete loss of its own geopolitical and strategic autonomy.
At this point in time, the EU cannot be militarily independent. It can't adopt autonomous strategies. Today, Europe must create its own defense system so that in 30 years' time, it can really be geopolitically autonomous. If we continue to put national interests ahead, all individual states, including Italy, would lose geopolitical relevance.
Michel's remarks come as Ukrainian and international politicians and experts are warning that ammunition shortages are resulting in the losses of territory to Russia.
Michel is trying to keep Germany under pressure, demanding together with the French government that Berlin provide Ukraine with long-range cruise missiles Taurus. German Chancellor Scholz has so far said no to this request to avoid a war escalation, adding that his country has already provided Kiev with arms for 7 billion euros, while France is struggling to pay for Ukraine military aid.
On Wednesday, the Italian former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte accused the current Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni of dragging Italy into World War III after having turned the country into an irrelevant, subjugated power. Max Civili, Rome.
Nowruz, the beginning of the Persian New Year, has always given energy and hope to people celebrating the event to observe Iranian traditions and enter the new year with a totally fresh spirit. The arrival of Nowruz for Iranians is tantamount to shopping spree and finishing their undone work. Millions of Iranians embrace the turn of the Persian year and celebrate the spring festival with many ceremonial customs waiting to be observed.
Well, everybody is busy shopping. It is time of Nowruz and the new year. I have bought sabze, sweets and fruits. We're waiting for the new year to arrive.
Sofre Hafsin is unique, symbolic for the Nowruz festivity and its tradition. The Hafsin spread includes 7 items, all starting with the letter Sin in the Persian alphabet. Iranians say there's a history behind each element, including serke, vinegar, symbolizes patience and immortality, sumac represents love and compassion, sib, apple, is a symbol of health and fertility, senjit, silverberry, is seen as a simulator of love and affection. Sabze, sprouts, symbolizes rebirth. Seed or garlic is a symbol of protection in the face of affliction. And samanu represents affluence.
This year it's different, as it has coincided with Ramadan. So we visit our family members and parents after iftar. And yes, it is great.
Nowruz is a unique opportunity for families and relatives to get together and visit each other. That is why Nowruz is regarded as a cultural bridge which unites people. This year, as Nowruz holidays coincide with the holy month of Ramadan, family members will most likely meet up after sunset or time of iftar when those who are fasting break their fast. Nowruz has begun and the Iranians are celebrating it as an ancient festivity to mark the first day of spring and the renewal of life and nature. This year, Nowruz has a different flavor to it as the Iranians are celebrating it with the holy month of Ramadan together, making it an exception. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Earlier this month, the Maidenhead constituency in southeast England woke up to the resignation of its Conservative MP of 27 years, former Prime Minister Theresa May. Hers was one of up to 100 other well-established as well as younger MPs across the political parties announcing they wouldn't be running in the yet-to-be-announced next general election. Scottish Nationalist Party member Martin Day explains why so many are choosing to go.
For some, it's just age. They've reached retirement age and they're going. For others, they've got family commitments and they want to do that or other things with their lives. But for some, it's the toxic nature of politics. It's the toxic nature on social media where they're being trolled. And for some, they're actually being physically stalked and threatened with violence.
One MP, Caroline Lucas, the Parliament's only Green MP of 14 years, has cited the dysfunctionality of Parliament as her reason.
This Parliament has always been dysfunctional. I think perhaps one of the benefits of social media and modern television is that we see it more. It's not fit for this 21st century. I don't think it was fit for the 20th century. It's a Victorian construct, and it worked in their day. It doesn't work in our day. We should have electronic voting, we should have proportional representation systems, and we shouldn't have an unelected second chamber.
But while resignations are not uncommon ahead of a general election, it is different this time round. At least as far as the ruling Tories are concerned.
Well, you've heard the phrase, rats deserting a sinking ship. Clearly, the Tory ship is sinking, and that's why so many of them are jumping overboard and seeking refuge elsewhere.
Britons will vote in local elections in May. The Tories are 26 points behind the opposition Labour Party in opinion polls. Pressure is growing on Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to call an early national vote.
As it stands, there won't be a general election in May, but one in the second half of the year seems more likely. Nevertheless, catastrophic results in the upcoming local elections could mean that Rishi Sunak and his Conservative Party's days in power are numbered. Saeed Purizap, London.
South Korea this week hosts the third U.S. initiative of the Summit for Democracy. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken suggested America could lead the world toward democratic ideals lacking elsewhere.
Vitalizing democracy will also require us to shape a technological future that's inclusive, that's rights-respecting, directed at driving progress in people's lives. As authoritarian and repressive regimes deploy technologies to undermine democracy and human rights, we need to ensure that technology sustains and supports democratic values and norms.
Corralled away from the venue, activists were joined by a South Korean lawmaker to question Washington's and Seoul's credibility, particularly in light of U.S. support of Israel's ongoing genocide of Palestinians in Gaza.
Since Yoon Suk-yeol came into power, our democracy index has fallen by 19 points, and we're turning into a very backward country in terms of democracy. The United States, the enabler of the massacre, Israel, the perpetrator of the massacre, and South Korea are causing the endless decline of democracy.
Activists say the U.S. and South Korea have the blood of tens of thousands of innocents on their hands through the provision of weapons to Israel and failure to pressure Tel Aviv to end its genocide.
It's not the time for the South Korean government or the U.S. government, who are complicit in Israel's genocide, to discuss democracy. Instead, the Korean government should urge the U.S. and Israel to immediately stop the genocide, lift the blockade of the Gaza Strip, and end Israel's colonial military occupation of Palestine.
While a rift has appeared in U.S. support of Israel, concern is mounting that the Israeli military will increase attacks on the already besieged Rafah, where Palestinians await humanitarian aid amid reports of starvation. Like here, around the world can be found supporters of a free Palestine protesting against Israel's genocide in Gaza week after week. And here at this summit titled Democracy for Future Generations, a glaring question clouds proceedings. What will happen to the next generation of Palestinians? Frank Smith, Seoul.
The people of Afghanistan are facing immense hardship and sorrow, with the country finding itself at the bottom of the World Happiness Report rankings. The report, which evaluates nations based on various factors such as freedom, health, and income, has named Afghanistan as the unhappiest, where almost everyone is very unhappy.
Everyone here agrees with the result of the World Happiness Survey. We are unhappiest, and that is because of the ongoing poverty, unemployment, and lack of freedom and opportunities. Furthermore, girls cannot receive education, which further adds to the misery of Afghan families. When women are despaired, families feel unhappy.
I have been unemployed for almost 3 years. Since then, I have not had any income. My young daughters are missing their school, and this situation is so tough. How can we be happy? The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
The Afghan people have suffered decades of intervention and war, and they have not been happy. But experts say, under the rule of the Taliban, their circumstances have worsened.
As we speak, mental clinics across Kabul are receiving more patients than ever. As a psychologist, I witnessed the rise of mental health problems such as anxiety, stress, and depression. They have even led to suicide. If you take hope away from people, it will result in a depressed and dead nation. Hope is everything for human beings. If it is eroded, all progress will be lost.
The Afghan people are resilient, but the absence of basic human necessities and rights can crush even the strongest will. The international community and the ruling Taliban share a responsibility to bring some hope and light to the life of the crisis-stricken nation. Decades of foreign interventions and war have made Afghans the poorest and the saddest people on the planet. This nation has long yearned for peace and happiness, but it remains to be seen when or whether they find their lost dream. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The appointment of a new Palestinian prime minister at the current circumstances could deepen divisions as the Israeli war on Gaza rages. This is what some Palestinian factions revealed after President Mahmoud Abbas appointed Mohammed Mustafa, a long-trusted advisor on economic affairs, as prime minister and tasked him with forming a new government.
Both Hamas and resistance movements, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the Palestinian National Initiative, said that without national consensus, it's a reinforcement of a policy of exclusion and the deepening of division. We met Dr. Mustafa Al-Barghouti, Secretary General of the National Initiative. He told us that the most important thing is now a unified leadership.
We're not against the new government. We're against the way the government is being formed. We want a national consensus government, a government which is acceptable and accepted by all Palestinian political groups through a national dialogue between the different groups. And that is natural because, and for us, the main goal first before forming a government is how we structure a unified Palestinian national leadership.
Mohammed Mustafa replaces Mohammed Shtayyi, who resigned less than 3 weeks ago, citing the need for real change. Experts, however, say there had been mounting pressure on Abbas to reform the Palestinian Authority and initiate the establishment of a political framework capable of governing a future Palestinian state to take charge of all Palestinian territories after the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza ends.
First of all, that there was a pressure on the Palestinian Authority to make some changes, and that's why they complied immediately and appointing Mohammed Mustafa as the new prime minister. This is on the one hand. On the other hand, which is most importantly as well, what the Palestinians wanted. The Palestinians don't want another government to be the same. The problem here is with Israel. Are they, and the international community, are they able to really make the change and let this government to work or not?
The new prime minister now would work to form a technocratic government of experts. Abbas has also asked Mustafa to create plans to reunite the administration of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, reform the government, and address internal corruption. A real political change, not a change in words only, is what the people here desire. Moreover, the upcoming government faces numerous challenges, namely rebuilding the Gaza Strip, torpedoing Israeli plans to control the coastal enclave, and managing Palestinians' lives. Mona Kandil, Occupy Jamallah.
On Saturday, thousands of people joined a new rally in the Italian capital, organized, among the others, by the movement of the Palestinian students and the Association of the Palestinians in Italy. The initiative, dubbed Stop the Genocide, also saw the participation of high school students and families. People at the rally strongly condemned Italy's unwavering support to the Israeli regime.
Italy, that claims to be a democratic nation, is a country where the government goes against the people's will. Profits always come first, even when a genocide is taking place. I'm teaching my kids to never give up the fight and to never accept being submitted.
The Italian Defense Minister Guido Crosetto has recently said that Rome has continued to export arms to Israel despite assurances last year that the government was blocking such sales following Tel Aviv's invasion of the Gaza Strip. Some Italian media reports recently revealed that despite the Italian government's denials, the value of arms sales to Israel more than tripled in December 2023 compared with the same month in 2022. And December last year was the peak of Israeli bombardments on the Gaza Strip.
Western governments have been systematically supporting Zionism and Israel's criminal regime, notwithstanding the protest against Israel's crimes that have been taking place across the globe. Italy's support to Tel Aviv must stop once and for all.
La soluzione sarebbe...
A solution to the onslaught in Gaza could be found if the international community stopped militarily supporting Israel. Italy, on its side, has been actively arming Israel through companies such as Leonardo and others. If we don't make sure that the Palestinians' right to self-determination is protected, and nothing will ever change.
Earlier this week, more protests and initiatives in solidarity with the besieged Palestinians were held in several Italian cities, including Milan and Naples. Max Civili, Rome.
a growing strategic partnership between Azerbaijan and Iran in the energy sector on full display. A collaboration that promises to bolster economic development and energy security beyond the borders of the two countries and in the region, as described by the Iranian Minister of Energy and his visiting Azerbaijani counterpart. A highlight of this cooperation is the near completion of hydroelectric power plants on the Aras River, a vital waterway on the Iran-Azerbaijan border, with construction progress reported at 96%. The strategic importance of these hydroelectric projects extends beyond national benefits, signaling a move towards greater energy independence and regional cooperation, including the creation of an energy bridge linking Azerbaijan, Iran, and Russia by connecting Iran and Russia's power grids through the Republic of Azerbaijan. This follows decisions made 2 weeks ago during the 17th Iran-Russia Joint Economic Commission in Tehran to boost economic relations in different fields. Managing shared water resources for energy production lays the groundwork for more mutually beneficial cooperation, which is why the presidents of both countries will be attending the inaugural ceremony. The projects are in the final stages, promising a significant boost in Iran-Azerbaijan bilateral relations, all in line with President Ebrahim Raisi's policy to expand relations with neighboring countries. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is me, Asma. Once more, I have the pleasure to be at your service. And then here with me, I have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Mustafa. And assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum assalam.
So, as the ritual of this program goes, I would love you both to introduce yourself pretty briefly. Let's start with Sister Nahid.
Assalamu alaikum to you and your dear listeners. My name is Nahid. I'm an MA graduate of CFO, and I'm so honored to be with you and your listeners today.
Thank you very much for being here, and you, Brother Mustafa.
My name is Mustafa, and I'm studying here in the Hoza. I'm studying psychology here, and I'm originally from Pakistan, but I've lived in different countries.
So, thank you very much, both of you, for coming here and for joining us in today's episode. In this episode, we're going to talk about sobbing, crying, and weeping. And it's not going to be all negative. We're going to look at it from different dimensions. First, the philosophy of crying and why do we human beings cry?
I think there's two ways to maybe answer that question. One would be from a psychological point of view, and another one would be from like the Quran and religion, because God talks about crying many times in the Quran, right? From a psychological point of view, you know, psychologists will tell you that the reason we cry is, you know, they'll normally give five or six different emotional reasons. Like they'll say because of sadness, because of anger, because of joy, because of frustration, and because of like empathy, right? These are some of the reasons.
Whenever there are emotions inside of you, you might get
prone. They'll say like it causes like a physiological reaction, like you're, and this does happen, like, you know, your brain produces certain hormones. And due to these emotions, you'll have crying. In most cases, psychologists say it's good to cry, by the way.
Yeah.
I really take issue with the part at which we are dealing with our own characteristics, with the psychological aspects in which it has too many reasons. Sometimes even being overfeeling something, like being overexcited, even these kinds of issues can cause us cry. I don't think that it's a bad issue. I, first of all, would like to talk about the meaning of crying. Like, too many people regard crying as a bad thing. Like, if a person is crying, it means that person is labeled as a sad, depressed, or anxious person.
Yeah.
But crying is not like that. It's rooted in our human notion. And, like, we are having this feeling within ourselves, and it's not something not natural or like a sign of depression.
No, it's a part of us. But then if we go to the excessive amount of crying, then that would be depression.
Yeah, it should be diagnosed and found, like, what is the reason behind it?
Right.
And
Yeah. So, yeah. Brother, you said there is a religious perspective.
I would say, yeah, like crying too much depends on why you're crying, right? And from an Islamic point of view, if you're crying too much because, let's say, you're remembering God or you're remembering, you know, the Prophet and the Imams, then it's not considered a negative thing. But if you're like crying over like minor issues in your life, for example,
yeah,
right?
Or
you're
like, why this happened to me? Why me?
Yeah, or like if you're feeling embarrassed after crying, or you're avoiding like social situations, you know, because you're crying, those times you should definitely seek help. We have at least 5 different verses of the Quran which talk about this, and God gives different reasons for why someone would cry.
So I guess we can keep it in here. Just remember what you're going to say. Let's go for a break, and then we'll be back to see.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So, welcome back, dear listeners. Thank you for staying with us. This is Back to Reality. I hope you're enjoying today's episode. Well, we're talking about crying, and it's sort of paradoxical to enjoy a discussion about crying. Yeah. So you said that there are some verses.
Yeah, so there's at least 5 different verses which talk about, you know, crying. For example, the very first one, and I'm not going to quote which chapter and which verses. You know, if people want to go and research this, they can. They can look it
just
up. It's
the main
all online.
Idea.
But yeah, one is like when we perceive reality, right?
Oh,
so this is the show. This is Back to Reality. We should be crying right now because we're perceiving
reality. So even
reality.
The psychological factors say that when you are facing reality, you would cry.
Well, in this verse, God is saying that, you know, when they hear what's been revealed to the prophet, you will see their eyes are overflowing on account of the truth that they recognize. So sometimes when you recognize truth, you know, at our heart level, we can start crying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we've all experienced this.
Exactly.
Maybe you're reading the Quran or we're reading, you know, we're hearing about something, we may start crying. Another case, we cry for repentance. I think that people all know that one. That's sort of self-explanatory. Then God says shedding tears is among the signs of like someone who has wisdom or someone who has belief, right?
Yeah. So
like, for example, he says they fall down on their faces weeping and it adds to their humility, right? When they hear like the promises of God. For example, when you hear about heaven, you know, how amazing it will be or how terrible hell will be, that may make you cry sometimes, right? And finally, there's examples of many of the prophets that have cried, you know, that will cry, for example, of Prophet Jacob, Prophet Shoaib. And finally, in the worst, by the way, this I would say would relate to the psychological stuff that we talked about. It says that, you know, tears of regret are a remedy for those who have gone astray.
Mm-hmm.
Right? God says, there shall be none besides God to remove them from, you know, when the Qiyamah is there. Do you then wonder at this announcement and will you laugh and not weep?
Mm-hmm.
Right? God is saying like how difficult that day of judgment will be. Are you going to laugh about it or are you going to like, you know, weep about it? Like
of
he's saying this will bring you to the path.
Yeah. So those are very nice and interesting verses to think about. Then there's another point to crying. I guess from a human perspective, if we just put ourselves in the main center of attention and talk about crying, I would say that sometimes crying is a sign to a situation in which you have no control upon it. Like everything is going to an extreme that there are no longer words to describe what you're feeling. There are no longer solutions for what you're going through. Then those tears come out. Like we have a poem by Tennessee Williams that says, "Tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean. Tears from the depth of some divine despair that gather in the heart and rises to the eyes." This is very interesting that tears have a direct link to your heart and what your heart is going through. So whether it be a religious situation, like when you remember the battlefield of Karbala and what Imam Hussein alayhi salam went through, your heart is going to pound even faster than ever. And then since there's a direct link, your eyes are going to pour it all out. Sometimes just when you are facing the reality, just as the brother mentioned, you would go through crying. So crying, I guess, is a tool for human beings to let it all out.
Yeah, and speaking of the religious part, I really, I sometimes get annoyed that people label Islam as the religion of crime.
Depression, like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They label Muslims as the depressed people who are always crying without even searching for the reason, like what is the thing behind Muslims crying on Ashura night, for example.
Crying and just put those reasons aside. After those crying sessions that we have, after listening to the stories and whatsoever, you can see that people are even happier. I guess whenever we come out of those lecture sessions or things like that, we feel like our heart has been refreshed.
Exactly. It's like we free ourselves from the from the emotions that we cannot control again in this case. Like, we can officially do nothing for the things that happened years ago, but at